In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some recent changes in the airline industry and the impacts of those changes on consumers. And our guest for the program is Paul Hudson. He's executive director of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. This is a nonprofit organization that was founded by Ralph Nader back in 1971. They're interested both in issues of safety and consumer rights. Among other things, they were very important in forcing airlines to begin to offer free tickets to people who were bumped from confirmed seats when the airlines overbook. They also were very important in getting the baggage liability limits on lost or damaged baggage increased, and they played a very important role in banning smoking from flights of 6 hours or less. And they certainly follow airline issues. We'll be trying to talk about a number of things this morning. We'll talk a little bit about some of the consolidation that's gone on in the industry recently and what that means for consumers. We'll also look at the issue of delays. One of the big complaints that people have nowadays about air travel is that there are so many delays. It seems to have certainly gotten worse in the last couple of years, and some people are predicting that this summer could be as bad, if not worse, than last summer. We'll talk about some of the proposed solutions to this issue, things that are both long-term items and shorter-term items, and, of course, whatever questions people have who are listening, you're welcome to call in and ask your question. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Hudson, hello.
Yes.
Yes, hi. Thanks for talking with us today.
Okay.
We appreciate it. I thought I would just maybe talk a little bit first about some of the issues around consolidation. And to start, there has been a proposed deal that's been on the table now for a while. United would like to buy U.S. Air. It would make United the world's biggest airline, and it's a pending approval by the Justice Department. And this has been around for a while. The United and keeps setting new closing dates, and they keep missing them. The most recent one, I think, has been set is August 1st, and I think a lot of people think that that probably won't be met either. Do you think that this deal will be approved, or is this in trouble?
Well, generally, time is a enemy of mergers. It's hard to say, but the fact that it has been delayed several times indicates that there are some problems.
Well, is it possible to say, or I don't know if your organization has taken a position on whether this would be good or bad for consumers, for people who fly?
Well, we've taken a position that as it's proposed, it should not be approved. We're not, however, absolutely opposed to it. We believe that the best antidote for the consolidation, which is going on not only with United, but also American has taken over TWA, and there's a threat of having 3 to 5 major carriers that would control about 90% of all the seats within a year. The main antidote for that is to have fair access rules and fair competition rules, which we presently don't have in this industry. And secondly, we think we need to look at allowing foreign investment in domestic airlines, because the industry is right now sheltered completely from foreign competition.
Yeah, I want to come to that in a moment, but I want to go back to another point that you made. There was another big deal that did go through. That's the purchase of TWA by American. And some people, when that deal was proposed and this other deal was out there, the United U.S. Air deal, they said, well, if those two things happen, then it seems inevitable that some kind of deal also would take place between the remaining major carriers, Delta, Northwest, and Continental. And as you say, the possible end outcome would be that we would end up with having just a handful of carriers, 4 or 5, controlling almost all of this country's airline seats. Do you think that indeed some, whether or not the the United U.S. air deal does not happen, does that mean that there would be less? It would be less likely that some other consolidation involving the remaining big carriers would take place?
I think so, you may still see some divestiture or changes in the acquisition of TWA. Right now, it's being operated as a subsidiary, and there are still some issues to be resolved before it can be integrated. The big problem with consolidation right now is that in most industries, you have consolidation and mergers going on constantly, and you have companies constantly getting in financial trouble and going out of business. But what you lack in this industry, which you have in most industries, is new entrants coming in. People are going out, but they're not coming in. And the reason they're not coming in to this industry is because it is essentially not possible for new entrants to compete on a level playing field with the existing large carriers.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of dimensions to that I know your organization is interested in. One is has to do with the fact that, as I understand it, foreign airlines cannot serve the domestic U.S. market. That is, say, for example, that British Air decided one day they wanted to offer a flight from Chicago to Los Angeles. They couldn't do it.
That's right. We have a situation in the airline industry similar to what we had with electronics in the 1970s, where Japan had a sheltered market. And they would sell, for instance, color TV sets for $500 in Japan, and they would sell the same thing here for $250. And by doing that, they would get profits in their sheltered home market, very high profit margins, and they would use that to gain market share elsewhere in the world and to drive also American companies out of business. The U.S. Major carriers, the top six anyway, are following the same procedure here. They have very high profit margins on domestic routes because they're completely sheltered from foreign competition. And they have lower margins, and they use that profit to expand overseas and to compete overseas.
This is a matter of U.S. law. That is, and if this was going to be changed to allow competition from foreign carriers, this would take congressional action.
Yes, it's right now we have some Cold War era laws that prohibit any foreign person or corporation from owning more than 25% of a domestic carrier, and regardless of what they own, they're not allowed to control a domestic carrier. So what that means is that not only can't we have foreign subsidiaries here, as we can in every other industry, automobiles, electronics, whatever, but it also means that when smaller companies get in trouble or need capital financing, and this is a very capital-intensive industry, it takes a lot of money to operate an airline, they cannot get any foreign capital.
So there again, for example, the case we talked about or touched on, American bought TWA. At the time, some people were saying that if that deal wasn't allowed to go through, that TWA would simply go out of business. There, one option might have been that, say, a foreign airline could have come along and said, well, we'll buy and operate TWA. But again, that's something that U.S. law wouldn't allow.
Absolutely. Had that law not been in effect, you would probably have had a line around the block at the courthouse of companies like British Air, KLM, Alitalia, Air France, looking to buy TWA. It would be very, very valuable property. The problem also is that you cannot, as I say, get startups here easily when you don't have access to world capital markets.
Mm-hmm.
For one airplane now, it costs about $150 million for a new jetliner. And with the competition rules not allowing fair access to some of the key facilities, especially at major airports, and this bar on foreign competition, we have a real problem. the rules were enacted largely with the idea that we would have to convert our domestic airliner fleet to troop carriers on a moment's notice should the Soviets invade Western Europe. But with the end of the Cold War, that rationale is gone.
Do other countries have similar laws that, U.S. air carriers, can they offer domestic service in other countries if they would want to, or could they go and they could buy pieces of other airlines?
Most other countries do have laws, but not all. And U.S. carriers are buying into and sometimes controlling foreign carriers. There's also a tradition that to control the domestic airspace is similar to controlling your coastal waterways as an attribute of sovereignty, if you will. Mm-hmm. However, the U.S. Policy on this has been, for the last 20 years at least, what is called open skies, meaning in theory, the U.S. policy is that any foreign airline should be able to fly anywhere in the U.S., provided that U.S. airlines could fly anywhere there. As a practical matter, this policy has failed because it relies on bilateral agreements with about 135 countries, and for the most part, major carriers in both of the countries block these agreements.
Let me introduce our guest once again here for anyone who might have tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking with Paul Hudson. He is executive director of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. It was founded in 1971 by Ralph Nader, and they're interested in both issues of safety, air safety, and also consumer rights. And we're talking here about what's been happening recently in the U.S. air industry, and your questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners, but anyone, anywhere, can use the toll-free line 800-222-WILO. One other matter here that has to do with competition or the difficulty of mounting a competition to a major carrier that affects U.S. carriers is that the majors have a lot of gates locked up at various airports, and that also makes it very difficult. If you were a smaller carrier, perhaps you had planes and you had crew and you could do it. You have to have somewhere to land and unload your passengers. And if there are no gates available for you to roll your plane up to, then that means that you can't serve that place, even if you are capable of serving that place.
Yes, this is one of the basic problems with not having a fair access rule. Any infrastructure industry, including airlines, to be successfully deregulated has to have fair access, whether it's telephones or natural gas lines or electric utilities. If the dominant company or the monopoly company can simply refuse to allow its facilities to be used by its competitors, then you have no competition possible. And it wasn't until that type of rule was enacted in those other industries that they were deregulated. In the airline industry, unfortunately, it was deregulated, but there was no fair access rule enacted. We don't even have a similar rule to what you had when trains were the main source of long-distance travel. Going back to the 19th and first part of the 20th century, we had shared gate rules at all the major railroad stations in the United States. So one railroad could not control the gates or the platforms. Any railroad could rent the space from another railroad, and if it wasn't using at that particular time, and if the price couldn't be agreed upon, then the government would arbitrate and set the price.
When the airlines we deregulated, this was in the 1970s, the promise was made that there would be greater choice through competition, and that people talked about having a number of major carriers. And in fact, what has happened through the consolidation that we've seen and the possibility of further consolidation is that we just got a handful of airlines that control most of the flights. when we ask the reason, why is it that deregulation has, there's been a contraction, a bit of consolidation rather than the other thing, is it mostly this thing that we've been talking about here, that is that the atmosphere, the rules just make it very difficult for a competitor to come in?
I would say that those two things are the biggest, lack of fair access rules and lack of general free access to capital. There are other things also, but those have been the most important. The major carriers have figured out a number of ways to not have to compete, and especially not have to compete on price. And this has really enabled them to squeeze out most of the smaller carriers. We have only now one large low-cost carrier left, which is Southwest. And many of the other smaller ones have been squeezed out. And it does not look good for them in the next couple of years if we get into a recession.
Mm-hmm. There has been a bill that's come out of committee in the Senate that addresses this issue. And I believe this was a bill that was sponsored jointly by Fritz Hollings and John McCain that would address this issue of competition. It's called the Aviation Competition Restoration Act. And I'm not sure where this thing is and whether other people in Congress have been talking about this issue. What possibility do you think that there is that there would be some attempt through legislation to address this issue of competition?
Well, there are approximately 18 bills that have been introduced this year in Congress on either passengers' rights or competition. The McCain-Hollings bill was reported out of committee and may well be voted on in the Senate in the next few weeks. But unfortunately, the parts dealing with competition were pretty much gutted and eliminated in committee. And it does little more than ask for more intensive studying of the problem. There is a stronger bill that was introduced last week, combining several bills sponsored by Congressman Dingell and Congressman Sweeney, which is a bipartisan bill that is a much stronger bill on both passengers' rights and competition. Also, our organization and about 10 other consumer and industry groups, national organizations, are sponsoring a conference on the 23rd and a set of common proposals for competition and passengers' rights will be issued. So we are hopeful that there'll be some activity this year, but the House, unfortunately, has not held any hearings on legislation. And the Senate has reported out a rather weak bill, which largely would make mandatory some of the voluntary service improvements that the airlines agreed to a couple of years ago.
So now this is the Airline Competition and Passenger Rights Act?
Well,
or did it get? I may be a little behind on my.
The McCain bill, which is 319, and the Hollings bill got combined.
Ah, okay.
And reported.
Okay.
But some of the stronger provisions regarding competition in the Hollings bill were deleted in committee.
Right. Just for one moment, one other thing under the heading of mergers, and then I want to go out and talk about some other things. We talked a little bit right at the beginning about the merger or the proposal by United to buy U.S. Air, the one that's been now on the table for a while. And the longer it sits, the more you begin to wonder whether or not it would happen. With the other deal, the TWA American deal, some people said, well, if this doesn't go through, TWA goes under. Some people, I think, are saying the same thing about this deal, that if United isn't allowed to buy U.S. Air, then perhaps U.S. Air can't survive by itself. Do you think that that's the case?
Well, anything is possible, but U.S. Air, until quite recently, has been profitable since 1995 every year, and they are not in any kind of TWA situation now. Their stock has held up quite well, especially considering what's happened to a lot of other companies in the current stock market. The if they are lagging, it appears to be for two factors. One, they apparently have relaxed themselves management-wise and have figured that the merger may have been a done deal, and that often happens when these things are proposed, and then there's a long time in between proposal and consummation. The other thing is that they've just had some major labor negotiations, and they are facing competition from Southwest in their northeast area that's been dominant. So if they were vigorously acting as an independent airline, I don't think they would be in any kind of danger.
We're just about at the midpoint here, this hour of Focus 580. Again, our guest for the program is Paul Hudson. He's Executive Director of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. And we're talking about what's been going on recently in the airline industry and what that means for consumers. Questions certainly are welcome from people who are listening here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to go on and talk about the issue of delays. This seems to be one of the, when you ask people who fly what their chief complaints are, there are probably many, but
that is the number one.
This is the number one. And not surprisingly, this winter, the Department of Transportation put out a report that found that delays had increased last year by 20%. That's on top of a 35% increase the year before. Now one in four flights is delayed an average of an hour, and people are unhappy about this. There apparently are a number of, when you ask people in the industry, well, what's the problem? You get different sorts of answers, and there are also long-term solutions, short-term solutions. The industry seems to blame primarily the FAA. They say this is an air traffic control problem. Other people look at the industry and say, no, this is not really, yeah, that may be some issues there, but there also are scheduling issues here that, in a sense, it's an industry problem. Who do you think primarily is to blame for these kinds of flight delays?
Well, the primary blame, we feel, has to fall on the industry and the airport authorities. Blaming air traffic control is a little like blaming the weatherman for bad weather. It's really a symptom, not a cause. Although there are times when air traffic control messes up, for the most part, that's not the case. The biggest problem that we see in the short term is there has been an enormous concentration of flights at a few airports. The top 20 airports now control over half of all the traffic. Out of 450 airports in the United States, the bottom 390 only have 6% of the traffic. And the top 60 airports controls 94% of the traffic. And within the top 20, which includes airports like Chicago O'Hare, which is the number two airport in the U.S. after Atlanta-Hartsfield, you have a concentration of flights at a few times during the day, at certain popular times during the day. And we have overscheduling now to the point where it is chronic, and it is causing massive delays in backups, even in good weather. And when there is bad weather or there's equipment failures, then we have, in essence, transportation brownouts.
Well, your organization, I think, has made what seems to be a relatively simple short-term solution, and that is you think that airlines should be required to tell people their on-time record and to say, particularly for those flights that are chronically delayed, to put that information out there. I guess then the hope would be that people who really do have a choice would look at the flights that are chronically delayed and those that are not and say, well, let's take the flight that's more likely to leave on time than the one that's chronically delayed.
Yes, last year we proposed what's called a truth in scheduling rule. And that would require that the airlines tell you the on-time statistic for any flight that you're considering taking if the flight is chronically delayed, which we define as being late more than half the time. We're glad to see the U.S. DOT Inspector General has endorsed that, and that proposal is in the McCain bill. There are two other parts to the rule, though, that haven't been so far taken up, and that would ban what we call deceptively scheduled flights, that is, flights that are late more than 80% of the time. And believe it or not, there are about 2 to 4% of the schedule is in that category. These are flights that are virtually always late. And we feel that if those flights were eliminated and they were not rescheduled until they were scheduled accurately, and you were notified as to what the on-time performance, it would be a little like saying, well, there's an 80% chance of rain tomorrow. Do you want to plan a picnic? Some people will say yes, but most will pick flights that are more on time, and that will, we feel, with arming consumers with accurate scheduling information, that will hopefully reduce, if not eliminate, the overscheduling.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the airlines say, well, we have to lie to you a little bit about the schedule, because if we schedule our flight for 8:30 and everyone wants to fly at 8 o'clock, you'll book a flight on our competitor.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. You have questions for our guest, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if the guest could comment on the role of Carl Icahn in TWA's troubles, current and former. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. Mr. Hudson? All right.
Well, Mr. Icahn is I'm sure the caller and many people know, used to own TWA, and he bowed out of the airline. However, he had some contracts which allowed him to buy tickets at a major discount. That was one of the reasons that was blamed for the bankruptcy of the airline. And he attempted to buy it out of bankruptcy, but his bid was rejected by the court, and the bid of American was approved. I was at the court at the time, and we did file some papers on this, and I must say that it was clear to me with the hundreds of demonstrating employees there at the bankruptcy court in Wilmington, Delaware, that he was really despised by the employees, and that his proposals were probably something that was not going to fly no matter what.
And this arrangement that he had with TWA to acquire these, what he could do is acquire these large blocks of tickets at a great price and then turn around and sell them and make money. Now, American didn't have to honor that, did it?
No, the bankruptcy court voided those contracts.
Yeah. So you do, just going back again to the listener's question, was Icahn, was he the number one factor, or how would you rank that with anything else that might have contributed to TWA's decline?
I don't know if that was the only factor. There were a number of other things, and it wasn't clear that TWA really had to file bankruptcy, even though it did have losses. There had been another rescue attempt, which was apparently turned down because it involved replacement of the top management at the company.
Mm.
The fact is that as a result of that acquisition, while it appears that, at least for now, a lot of employees' jobs have been saved, consumers will no longer have access to the lower cost tickets, not only that Mr. Icahn's group was marketing, but in general, American Airlines has said they are going to eliminate the lower fares that TWA has traditionally been having to certain cities in Western Europe and to the Caribbean.
We have other callers. Let's go to someone from here from the Chicago area, line four. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry I tuned in late, so I'm not sure whether you talked about the upcoming possible difficulties this summer. My daughter's getting married in the East the weekend of June 24th, and had you talked about whether it looks like there's going to be major, airline problems around that time, or do you think things might be more resolved by then?
Well, there are a number of labor negotiations still outstanding, although some have been settled.
Uh-huh.
In general, we advise people to have a plan B and to expect that their flight may well be excessively delayed or canceled.
Uh-huh.
Because even without a major strike or major weather problem, we're now to the point where 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 4 flights are being delayed and about 1 out of 10 up to 1 out of 10 are canceled.
Yeah, I heard that. So you're talking
about... So you don't have the reliability that you did.
Yeah.
We have a handbook called Facts and Advice for Airline Passengers, which you can get from us, which details how you can avoid or deal with the most common problems, including excessive delay and cancellations.
And could you give me some information about how to get that?
You can get it, the current version. You can order it from us. We have an 800 number, which is 588-ACAP. That's 588-ACAP.
ACAP. 588-ACAP?
Yes. We also have a website, which is acap1971.org.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Maybe here I should again, just real quick, introduce our guest once again. We're speaking with Paul Hudson. He is Executive Director of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. This is an organization that was founded by Ralph Nader in 1971, so that's where the 1971 comes in the website name. They are interested in both air safety and consumer rights. And so you can find them on the web if you're interested. And also there's that toll-free number if you're interested in getting a copy of that book that our guest has mentioned, Facts and Advice for Airline Passengers. The expectation seems to be that this summer will be probably as bad as last, if not worse.
I can't say, but it could be worse. If it's better, it's probably not going to be a lot better. Although in the Midwest area where you're located, hopefully we will not have a major strike at United, which is one of the major problems that we had last summer.
Hmm.
There's also, though, some other endemic problems, especially at O'Hare, which has become a major bottleneck, not only for the Midwest, but for the country. And some things have to be done to get around that problem. We're going to see, I think, continued increasing chronic delays. In addition to the truth in scheduling rule, we feel that in the short term, we need to start using larger airliners for transportation between major metropolitan areas. This would relieve the congestion we now have at places like O'Hare. The airlines decided in the mid-90s that they would rather use smaller 100 to 200 passenger jets, even for very long flights, and they began cashing in their wide-body jets that carry normally 250 to 500 people. As a result, we have many more flights, but we're not carrying that many more people at these airports. We also feel that you need to have a mandated reserve requirement for flight crews and for equipment. One of the main sources of delays in the Chicago area and nationally has been that airlines are operating now with about 1% to as bad as negative 8% reserves of flight crews, which means that unless pilots volunteer for overtime, or even when they do, there's going to be cancellations and excessive delays every day.
Mm.
The airlines have, in essence, been passing that cost and that inconvenience onto the customer. And just like we need reserve requirements for banks. We need reserve requirements in this industry, which is a major infrastructure industry, if we're going to have reliable service. And finally, we think we need to have sharing of the airport facilities in major metro areas. And in places like Chicago, we probably need an additional airport. Those things will relieve somewhat the congestion we have now, and they can be done in a matter of weeks or months. They don't require proposals such as a new air traffic control system or new airports and runways that can take many years to accomplish.
Let's go on to, we have another caller here. This is another Urbana person, line number one. Hello. Is the caller there in Urbana on line one?
Oh, I didn't hear you say one. I'm interested in air quality within the plane for, you know, health reasons. Is there any way to find out, are any planes better, or is it just purely the discretion of the pilot?
Until the mid-70s, all airliners had 100% fresh air they would bring in, and they had pretty good ventilation systems. However, starting in the mid-70s, airliner manufacturers allowed airlines to cut back on fresh air and to recirculate part of the air and to reduce the amount of ventilation. And as a result, we have a number of health problems potential as a result of this through germs, pollutants, and just plain not having enough oxygen or having too much CO2 in the air. We have studies which we can send you, and also our handbook, Facts and Advice, details some of the health problems and what you can do about them. We have petitioned the FAA to get rid of what we call bad air, and unfortunately that petition was rejected about a year and a half ago. And the airlines are now pushing to actually reduce the existing standards even further for fresh air.
Does that get at your question?
How would I get this information then?
You can write to us or call us. We have the 800 number, which is 588-ACAP-ACAP. Our website is acap1971.org.
A-T-A-P-P?
A-C-A-P, for Aviation Consumer Action Project. Our regular address is 529 14th Street Northwest, Suite 1265, and that's in Washington, D.C., 245.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go again to another caller here, back to Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hi. I got into the program late, so I don't know if you've covered this. And that is, with all this talk about the airlines and the shortage of space, particularly in the Chicago O'Hare area, nobody ever seems to talk about an alternative like high-speed trains. In O'Hare, I understand that half of the passenger traffic and the planes are for short-run purposes. That is 500 miles or less, and it seems to me, at least I'm convinced, that high-speed trains can handle this, and this will alleviate the entire problem of a third airport in the Chicago area and probably other airports around the country and all the hang-ups. Can you speak on this subject?
Sure. I've been riding the rails on the Northeast Corridor for over 25 years, and I've been waiting for over 30 years to get high-speed rail, and there's been one problem and delay after another.
Well, you certainly won't get it with this president and administration, but...
I don't know about that, but the problem is that we don't have that sort of service now.
Yeah.
And we're not going to get it in the next 5 or 10 years. Even the thing that's supposed to be starting now called the Arcella, which is a high-speed train between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C., that is supposed to compete with the airlines, has problems. It has reliability problems. And the amount of investment in this would be just enormous to have high-speed rails, say, between Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit or something like that.
But what about the whole problem of air pollution and weather cancellations? And are you saying that that the cost is all that much greater by using presently established rail lines, which are the old abandoned airlines, some of them still existing and not being used, others sold off? But can't those things be used and then be converted to for high-speed purposes and at a lower cost than the building of new airports, which run into the billions also?
No, I'm afraid the rail would be much higher. In for instance, in the Northeast, you first of all have to have a much different type of track system for high-speed rail. Then you have to, if you really want to be safe, you have to eliminate all the grade crossings, which is very expensive. Then you have to go to computerized switching equipment, which we don't have right now. And then, of course, the rolling stock has to be completely different. And you have problems with security. The fact is that rail is a potential, I would say, for areas like the Northeast Corridor, under 300 miles, and perhaps in California between San Francisco and L.A., but it's hard to see how it can be competitive with air in the next 20 years or so elsewhere in the United States.
How about the crowded skyways? Isn't this a huge drawback?
You know, the skyways are crowded, but only within 20 miles of the top 20 major airports. Most of the skies in most of America are virtually empty, and the reduction in overcrowding at the major metropolitan areas, we think can be handled with a combination of using larger airplanes, which means fewer actual flights, and by using smaller airports in outlying areas with regional jets. We have to spread out flights in both time and space, but we're not like Western Europe. We're not in a position where the skies are overcrowded over most of the U.S. now.
Yeah, well, the overcrowdedness being basically a problem about the right over the airports, well, this is critical. You don't get into the airports and... then you can forget about the whole thing, taking off or landing.
Well, what's happening now is that many of the airports in smaller and medium-sized cities, and I mean by that cities up to 750,000 or so, up to 1 million people, they have less airplanes flying in and out of them today than they did 10 or 15 years ago. And certainly their capacity factors are way down. And what's been happening is with a hub system that most airlines have adopted, they've been bringing people into these large airports or hub airports and switching them around and then putting them on other planes to fly to their destinations. It is possible to at least moderate that system in point-to-point, which Southwest has done very successfully, and to relieve a lot of this congestion that we have now. The airlines would have us believe that that everything is overcrowded and the system is ready to collapse, but that's not really the case. The number of people flying has been increasing, but only at about 1 to 5% a year, and there there are very few industries in the country that can't handle that kind of growth.
We at the point here, we have maybe a minute or two left, and I do want to touch on this point just a little bit further because, as you say, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, the industry, when you talk about delays, blames the FAA. They say this is an air traffic control problem. The system we have just can't handle the volume of traffic. And one solution that has been proposed by some people, and the industry seems to back it, is the idea that the air traffic control system should be privatized, something that I think your organization has taken a position against. You do say, I think, that the system could be improved, but that you don't like the idea of it being sold off.
Well, we don't take a position absolutely against it, but we feel that we should not take a government monopoly and turn it into a monopoly of the large carriers, which is what they want. If we're going to deregulate it, there should be a number of entities, and there should be an overall governing board. But that is not a solution to delays. In fact, in the short term and the medium term, it would probably increase delays. And there's no real knowledge as to whether it would actually improve it or make it worse. That, I would quote the chairman of Continental Airlines, Mr. Bethune. He said he called that a disinformation campaign by some of the large carriers. By blaming air traffic control and the FAA for delays, that fits into a political position of taking over the air traffic control system. Most of those proposals also involve big increases in consumer fees, which means higher airfares.
Well, we are going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say, Mr. Hudson, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Our guest, Paul Hudson, he's executive director of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. And again, they do have a website if you're interested in looking at more at them and their activities, www.acap1971.org or the toll-free line 800-588-ACAP.